For this nice conference. I'll be talking on work done in this first paper, which is sort of pedagogical with Max Tegmark, Shamit Kachru, Jesse Shelton, Ona Ozcan. And this second paper, which is sort of a more general and powerful result with Shamit Kachru, Wadi Taylor, and Max Tegmark. So, you know, cosmologists, many of you in this room, are asking various questions like, you know, what is the inflaton potential? What is its shape? And another question, where does the inflaton come from? What is that? And on the other hand, string theorists are asking various questions like, where in the space of string models or landscape is our universe, and what can be predicted? Well, it's entirely reasonable for cosmologists and string theorists to learn something from each other. For example, cosmologists might find that inflation provides the inflaton potential, and string theory might find that they can constrain all the space of string models by imposing cosmology. In our first paper, we advocated some kind of stringlish to English dictionary to help advocate this communication. So anyway, I'll quickly review very briefly the condition for inflation that everyone knows, and then talk about a corner of string theory, the type 2A theory, and its compactification from 10 dimensions to 4 dimensions. And we'll see that this string theory provides the right ingredients for inflation. Okay, now it's one thing to have the right ingredients, it's another thing to actually realize inflation in detail to get a bunch of E-foldings. And so I'll talk about the various fluxes that appear in this theory, and they give rise to this potential energy function. And by examining the shape of this potential energy function for a particular class of models that I'll specify precisely, I'll derive a no-go theorem that in this space of the landscape there is absolutely no inflation. So inflation then constrains string theory. And then I'll finish with the outlook of how to evade this no-go theorem. So cosmological inflation, as you know, explains a bunch of important stuff, like the horizon problem and flatness. And to do this, one introduces a scalar field phi with a gravity sector, kinetic energy, and a potential. And we need this potential to have a nice sort of shape. So we need a region here where it's flat in a certain sense to allow for exponential expansion as measured by this first slow roll parameter epsilon, which is m Planck squared over 2. Times the square of the derivative of the log of the potential, that has to be small. And it's the well-known condition. And this is for one field. If I have many fields, you just replace this derivative by the gradient on field space. And so, for example, you get a contribution from phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared and so on. And this is important because it tells you it's not enough for the potential to be flat in one direction in field space. It has to be flat in every direction in field space. Okay, and we'll use that later on. Now, the type 2A string theory, I'm not assuming this is a string audience, I'm just going to tell you some properties about it. So there are the various fields in 10 dimensions. There's gravity, some metric. There's a scalar dilaton field. And then there's a bunch of field strengths. Okay, so for example, this H3 here, you know, just as a point charge sources a Maxwell 2 form, a string being one dimensional sources this 3 form. And then there's various other P forms here, the F0, the F2, the F4, and so on in the 2A theory. And you can think of those as coming from the various brains of the theory. Should say, though, that you don't actually need to turn on any brains for these field strengths to exist, because they can wrap topologically non-trivial cycles of the compact space without any actual sources. However, there are some explicit sources you can turn on, and in the compactification I'll be interested in, which are Calabi-Yau's, we know how to consistently turn on D6 brains and these other things called O6 planes, which are sort of unique because they carry negative tension. So, for example, they violate the null energy condition. So here's the action of this theory. So up to some funny factors of e to the 2 phi, etc., it's more or less what you would guess. You have an Einstein-Ricci scalar, kinetic term for the dilaton, and kinetic term for each of these field strengths, the usual Maxwell kinetic terms. Then there's a contribution from integrating over the world volume of the D6 and the O6. Now, this is just the first term in some supergravity approximation. There are various other higher order corrections to this thing. Okay, so why study this particular theory? Right. Well, in 2005, the Wolf, Giritz, Kachru, Taylor, or DGKT, did something really remarkable. So they took this theory in 10 dimensions and compactified to 4D and outlined a general program to stabilize all fields, okay, under complete parametric control. So what do I mean by that? Well, again, these field strengths wrap cycles of the compact space, giving rise to fluxes. And in the 2A theory, those flux integers can take on arbitrarily large values, In fact, there's an infinite number of vacua. And as you take the fluxes to large values, all the quantum corrections that are left off here, they should get dialed parametrically towards zero. The back reaction gets driven towards zero. And you can operate at the supergravity level, trusting everything that you're doing. These are on Calabi-Yau's. Another motivation is that it's known that in 2A theory with D6s and whatnot on Calabi-Yau's are at least semi-realistic from the point of view of particle physics, because there are some beautiful constructions to build the minimal supersymmetric standard model. But I want to discuss its cosmology. Okay, so the compactification down to 4D, so it has this sort of structure. In the Einstein frame, you have a gravity sector, and then there's a bunch of kinetic energy terms. Okay, so this first term here is just the dilaton that we inherited from 10 dimensions, and then there's a bunch of fields that characterize the size and the shape of the compact space. So first of all, every compactification has a volume, and so there's some scalar field, the radius, if you like, associated with that. And then plus dot, dot, dot here, this is just all those other fields that the so-called moduli characterizing the size and the shape of the compact space. And we proved using the Kähler potential that it always has this form, that it decomposes into a dilaton volume plus other stuff that's positive. And that's important because it allows the dilaton and the volume alone to provide a lower bound on the slow roll parameter. Then finally, there's some potential energy function coming from all that other stuff in the 10-dimensional action, the fluxes, the brains, and the planes. And staring at this thing, you see that string theory provides the ingredients for inflation. Now, does this potential function, though, have the right shape to exhibit slow roll? So naively, this may not work. My starting point was that I wanted to consider compactifications that were really beautiful, were under parametric control. That doesn't guarantee they're going to have slow roll. So naively, why might this approach fail? So as we know, inflation, the potential typically requires some level of fine-tuning. For example, if you want to implement Linda's phi-squared inflation, one expects in a quantum theory of gravity there to be all sorts of Planck-suppressed corrections which might spoil slow roll. Okay, so a starting point might be, well, let's search for some sort of symmetry to protect against these higher order terms, a la Silverstein and Westphal that we heard earlier in the week, who exploited some sort of monodromy, and they included a whole bunch of elaborate ingredients. But the naive approach is just, perhaps we can just get lucky. Let's just appeal to large numbers and hope that somehow this thing is flat in a certain sense. So in that sense, why might this approach work? Okay, so here are the large numbers. In a typical compactification on a Calabi-Yau, you typically have hundreds of these scalar fields phi, so you have, let's say, at least 100 dimensional field space to explore to find inflation somewhere. Okay, furthermore, you have many, many, many potential energy functions. There's typically hundreds of fluxes. As I said, you integrate your p-forms over some cycle in the compact space, giving you some integer. This is a generalized Dirac charge quantization condition. If there are, say, 100 of these fluxes, and if each of them is allowed to take on n different values, that's n to the 100 different potential energy functions to explore. So you choose n to be 100 or something. This is a big number, like 10 to the 500 or something. In fact, in these 2A constructions, n is allowed to be infinitely large. This is an infinite number of potential functions I'm going to explore. And if that didn't work, well, you just change your topology because mathematicians have told us there are at least millions of Calabi-Yau's that I'm considering here. Okay, and they may in fact be much more than millions or infinite. Let's say exponentially large. In summary, we explored an exponentially large number of infinite or 10 to the 500, let's say, families of 4D models. Okay, does the potential function though have the right shape? So to give you a feeling for this, suppose you have a two-sphere of radius R, and you have a charge at the center Q, then there's an energy density that lives on the surface, which is just the electric field squared, which is Q squared over R to the 4. You should think of Q as one of those fluxes. Okay, and so R here is sort of the volume, parametrized the volume of the compact space. And so in general, all I'm telling you is that as you vary the size and the shape, these fluxes induce a potential energy function. This was for a Maxwell 2 form. For a Maxwell P form, you'll have some Q squared over R to the 2P. And various scalings depending on the structures you include in your theory. Now, I don't want to go through all the details of worrying about conformal factors from the string frame to the Einstein frame and so on and so forth, but we prove rigorously using the Kähler and superpotential law through direct dimensional reduction that in the Einstein frame, the potential has this form. Contribution from the H3 flux, the various P forms, the D6 and the O6, and it has this structure. So psi D here is just a name I'm giving for the dilaton field and psi V for the volume. Okay, I just show size for a moment. I'll replace those by phi's on the next page. So for example, the H3 flux scales like 1 over size, 1 over the dilaton squared and 1 over the volume cubed. This minus sign here in front of the O6 plane is again, as promised, the O6s carry negative tension, and this negative term is essential for stabilization. These really are nice models in 4D. Okay, apart from that, I wrote some functions here, for example, A sub 3 of phi j and so on. What do I mean by that? That's just a name I'm giving for that captures the information of all the other scalar fields in the theory. I'm only keeping track of the dilaton, the volume, and all the other stuff I'm dumping into there. Okay, so these are in general, by the way, very complicated functions of hundreds of fields, some hyperelliptic function or something. And you might think by exploring that structure, you might find inflation. But that's wrong. So here's a no-go theorem. So again, our potential has this form, and it's important to note that these psi's here are, so the dilaton is the exponential of phi, where the phi's are the ones that carry canonical kinetic energies. Okay, so bear that in mind when you implement the slow roll condition. So here's a fact. If you stare at this thing and you compute this linear combination of derivatives, minus 3 psi dilaton dv d psi dilaton, minus psi volume dv d psi volume, and you take this linear combination of derivatives and act term by term. So for example, when I act on the one coming from the H3 flux, I get 3 times 2, which is 6, plus 1 times 3, which is 9. And when I act on, say, this third term, I get 3 times 3, which is 9. And when I do it for this one, I get 9 plus p vp. And since the p-forms always give a positive energy contribution, this is bound to be greater than or equal to 9v. Okay, independent of whatever these other functions are, just using the fact that I know they're positive. Okay, so hence, if you divide both sides by v, and let's assume v is positive, because that's obviously, to get inflation, your potential has to be positive or the universe would just collapse. So divide both sides by v, and replace psi's by the phi's, which carry canonical kinetic energy, you get this inequality, which says that the potential, a derivative of the potential with respect to the dilaton plus a derivative with respect to the volume is bounded to be greater than or equal to 9. That means it's impossible for the potential energy function to be flat in every direction in field space, because it's either steep in the volume or the dilaton direction. If you keep track of all various factors of 9 and so on, you can prove that epsilon, the first slow roll parameter, is always greater than or equal to 27 over 13, again, whenever the potential is positive. So what are the implications? Since the first slow roll parameter is always large, there is no inflation. And this is a fact that's true anywhere in field space. I'm not at all assuming the volume or the dilaton plays the role of the inflaton. It could be any field, but epsilon is always large. It's true for any choice of fluxes. So by the way, these functions here, A, depend on all those hundreds of fluxes I mentioned. And it's true for any choice of Clavier. Okay, so this tells you a lesson that just because you have many, many vacua, 10 to the 500 or infinitely many, that doesn't mean that you're going to get inflation. That's because these potentials have some structure, which I just described to you. By the way, there's a corollary. Since epsilon is always large, in particular, it's bigger than zero. So there are no De Sitter solutions. That makes sense because De Sitter, in some sense, is just an extreme form of slow roll. What is the cosmology of these models? Well, the field vector, wherever it starts, will roll quickly down to some ADS vacuum. In ADS space, the epsilon can be zero. So they're nice compactifications in that sense. They're stabilized, but they don't have De Sitter space, De Sitter solutions, and furthermore, there's no slow roll inflation. Okay, so the string landscape, whatever the hell it looks like, we looked at a bit of it, and this picture's not meant to be to scale. I'll tell you how small this bit might be in a minute. All we can say is you are not here. We can just put a cross through this bit. Although some points here are potentially interesting from the point of view of particle physics, possessing the minimal supersymmetric standard model, you're not there. So inflation constrains string theory. Outlook, how do you go about evading this no-go theorem? Is it all doom and gloom? No, so remember what I did. I took this linear combination of derivatives and acted term by term, and got something that went like, and got an inequality that each term was greater than or equal to 9v. So this provides the following necessary condition. In order to inflate, a 2A compactification must contain some additional structure, which gives a term whose scaling leads to a right-hand side with a coefficient that's less than 9 if it's positive, or greater than 9 if negative. So do such structures exist in the theory? Well, the answer is yes. So there are other things we talk about in our paper, things like NS5 brains, the magnetic dual of the string, other things called geometric and non-geometric fluxes, D8 brains, O4s, etc. Well, if that's the case, why didn't we include all that stuff to begin with, you might ask? The point is it's difficult to include these things. For example, NS5 brains typically destroy supersymmetry at high scales. Geometric and non-geometric fluxes, we don't understand how to control them at large volume. D8s and O4s, we don't know how to include them on Calabi-Yau's. We included the simplest, well-understood ingredients, and for those ingredients, we had this no-go theorem. But we need some other structure in order to get inflation, so this no-go theorem should act as a guide towards what ingredients you need by breaking this inequality to get inflation. We need to tackle these less well-understood ingredients. So whilst I said you don't live here, maybe you live over here somewhere where there's more complicated stuff going on. We've heard examples of that in the people talk about brain inflation in the 2B theory, which involves a bunch of stuff involving non-perturbative corrections and warped throats and D3s and D7s and so on. We've heard Silverstein's construction with monodromies and Wilson curves and NS5 brains and nil manifolds and so on. So maybe we need all that kind of stuff for inflation. By the way, you might ask yourself, is it reasonable that our early universe should require such complication in order for inflation to work? I don't know. Personally, I think it's very reasonable. You know, a friend of mine reminded me that a DNA molecule, for example, looks hideously complicated from the point of view of an atom, but it's right. It may be that you need a bunch of complicated stuff in order to get slow roll inflation, and the naive idea that you can just appeal to large numbers, 10 to the 500 and whatnot, is not right. Okay, thank you. So, whilst it's true that 2A and 2B are related by some Mirati duality, that duality is only manifest when you include enough stuff. So, for example, if you include all the geometric and non-geometric fluxes and whatnot, that type of duality becomes manifest. With the restricted set of ingredients I've included, these sort of well-understood ingredients in the 2A theory, you don't see the duality to 2B. So the typical 2B compactifications that people talk about look very different. For example, you cannot stabilize all moduli at the classical level, which is what I'm talking about here. They appeal to higher order non-perturbative corrections and so on. So at the level I'm operating at, the duality is not manifest. I'm drawing no conclusions about 2B. Yeah. I wasn't able to say anything very profound about ether, although I didn't try hard enough. I mean, when I found epsilon was bigger than 27 over 13, I just said, right, that kills it right there. Sorry? Yeah, I don't think ether is much more complicated because, as you know, if you have many, many fields, to define ether, you have to pick a direction in field space and calculate some matrix, and it's like the lowest or highest eigenvalue, depending on its sign. So that's much more complicated. So I don't have anything profound to say about ether, since it's much more complicated involving matrices and whatnot. Although I thought about it briefly, but I don't know. I mean, it's a good point that you mentioned. I mean, it might be that you throw in some NS5 brain, for example, you find that right-hand side it comes out to be 8 or something, so you evade the no-go theorem, but it might be eta that kills you. But I don't have a proof of that, and I'm not suggesting it's true.